This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show, and thank you for your patience. I know it's been an extra week off. It's episode 252 with Anne Schnocke. She is an artist working in Oakland. She is the founder of a project space called Dream Farm Commons, which we talk quite a bit about. It's just actually such a wide-ranging and stimulating conversation you will find. We talk about everything from her growing up in Oakland and how the memories sort of flow through where Dream Farm Commons is, everything to computer snatching going on at the gallery. And one thing you will not hear in the recording is at one point as we were talking, Anne dropped the phone, ran outside, and broke up a sort of a casual, if you will, fight between a couple of kids, I guess teenagers, before coming back inside and continuing the conversation. So gives you a little bit of a taste of the context and environment that we spoke with each other from. And she also was a nurse practitioner for many years, and first nurse on the show, went to California College of the Arts at a relatively advanced age. She just has a lot of wisdom. So I think you will appreciate the thought-provoking conversation quite a bit. On the back end, we have some great old news, a.k.a. Weiss links. And the website for this show is still theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Anne's work, Dream Farm Commons. Go check that out. If you haven't seen the new revised theconversationpod.com, please go check it out. All right, so a lot to look forward to on the back end. Stick around till then, and thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you then. You live in Berkeley, you said, and you and Dream Farm Commons, where you are now. Your curatorial collaborative commons project is in Oakland, right? So
And I grew up in Oakland.
You grew up in Oakland, right?
Yeah, and I took like the neighborhood is like very specific for me because I took swimming lessons across the street, and my dad and I used to play pinball up the corner. He worked a block from here, and my mom worked two blocks from here. The Serbian church that I was referencing is like six blocks from here.
Right.
So it's very specific neighborhood.
Yeah. The fact that you grew up there, you have all these associations, and presumably it's changed so much. Is your sense that you're there now after, you know, so many years having grown up there in a very different time, that you love it so much and as well you want to sort of help shape its present and its, you know, its dimensions, as opposed to something more like, you know, fate or inertia? You know what I mean?
Oh, no. So my finding this place was that I come back from a residency in Argentina and Buenos Aires, and it was a very stimulating residency. And the months before I had gone to the residency, my mother had been in the hospital for months and I had been caring for her. And I came back and was like, I can't. She was back in the hospital. And I was like, I can't just go back into that. I've like something different has to happen. And I hooked up with someone who had a small gallery on 15th Street and was like, I need to do a show right now. And I was very much like, I need to do a show in this space. And then the space up the street opened up. And I was like completely clear that I had felt a sense of inertia of feeling a little trapped in studio space and feeling very much like I needed to create a public space. And that I needed, that I'd had these ideas about starting a kind of commons, or I had been a nurse for many years, for decades, and I ran this public art program in the city of Richmond, which is a very low-income Northern Bay community that at that particular time was the third most violent city in the country.
Wow.
So I was very, I was very involved in community, doing a performance and visual arts project that did works in public settings. And so I was really very much a part of social dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And being a nurse practitioner, I was very much, I was like healing people. I was like touching people's bodies and mm-hmm. and doing something very, very useful in the world. But at the same time, very, very much wanting to do work that worked at some other level of poetics and other levels of art conversations. So I went to California College of the Arts and got an MFA in that I just completed in 2012.
Okay.
So, mm-hmm. so that period after finishing the stimulation, the sort of, you know, intellectual stimulation of an MFA and kind of looking for like, where did I fit in the art ecology and like, you know, how much did I care about like applying to lots of, you know, how aggressive did I want to be about putting myself out in the art world? And I realized that I always preferred starting my own things than applying to somebody else's.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so,
right.
So I had, you know, that was like, and like I had this, when I was in the MFA program, I had this like vision or like this, like I was reading about Joseph Beuys and I just had this kind of like, I need to be in a place where we like have wool blankets and slate chalkboards and like we cook food. And
mm-hmm.
Like we have some like physicality of artistic production and at the same time are like crazy into levels of futuristic thinking and poetics.
Right.
So I kind of like knew that I needed all those things and was kind of like had been spending some years like trying to find that. And I would find that often like in residencies, I would get this super stimulated communal possibility sense. So when I came back from Argentina and was looking at, like, do I go back to sitting at my mother's bedside day in and day out, or, like, what else has to happen? And this space opened up on 15th and Webster, and mm-hmm. it was, like, just crystal clear to me, like, I don't know how it's going to work, but I need to, like, there's a loft upstairs that's, like, a social practice space. There's this amazing storefront that looks out on this graffiti building, and I can look across the street to this charter school for the arts where I actually used to take swimming lessons in the basement there. And it was completely like, I need to be in this neighborhood
mm-hmm.
and do this thing.
I want to ask you about your nursing work, but I mm-hmm. want to go back to my original question about
sure.
how you wound up or how you remain still in the East Bay, Oakland in particular. Was your caring for your mother a big part of the fact that you're still in the East Bay? Or, I mean, my question really was more, are you so attached to the East Bay that you feel like
oh,
you
totally.
Can never leave?
I feel like the East Bay, I love the East Bay. Like, I feel like I always say to people, like, I'm a very cosmopolitan person, but I never have lived really anywhere outside of the Bay Area
mm-hmm.
because why would I? Like, it's the best place in the world to live.
Right.
Which I feel after, like, I felt that, like I included San Francisco in that kind of reference until a few years ago. And now, like, I feel like San Francisco has really changed. It's really become this, you know, techno playground
mm-hmm.
for the young and for the young and moneyed. And I fear that the East Bay could become, is there a word for techno gentrification? I don't know what that combo is, but I,
well, it could,
you know,
it could take
that.
On, it could like San Francisco 2.0, it could become East Bay 2.0.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
totally. And that, you know, I really like I, oh, I just, a friend of mine just told me this statistic that I just love, which is that Alameda County only follows Queens, the borough of Queens, as the most linguistically diverse county in the country.
Right.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, from a Southern California perspective, the Bay Area does seem like, in a lot of ways, a great place. But two things. One, as you mentioned, you know, as what's happened with San Francisco, to some extent that's been happening with the with Berkeley and Oakland, right? So you've got that challenge, first of all. But second of all, I mean, the presumption of you're saying how, you know, how great the East Bay or the Bay Area is because you've been over the course of your life around the world or various places around the world, and you come back and you have that perspective. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. And I totally like, I love the old buildings of downtown Oakland, that there's a tremendous amount of character of this very like vital history of the shipyards, of the Great Migration, the African-American Great Migration in the 20s through to the activism of the 70s. And really knowing Oakland as a, it was a really emptied out place, downtown Oakland, for a period of time, like after the big department stores left, and there just wasn't a whole lot here for a long time. It was like at night, it would just be totally dead. And the kind of creative capital and creative energy that's in the downtown area now is like super awesome. It's great. And I love that, like, so many people who have been gentrified out of the Bay Area, young people that have been gentrified out to like Antioch and Pittsburgh, come into to Oakland for First Friday and for all the stuff that's going on in the downtown, the clubs and the music scene. And I did a project out in Antioch where we were asking people, where are the great places in Antioch? And there are some great places in Antioch, but many people said, well, the great places are really in Oakland. So,
right.
You know, it still is like a magnet for people of, for a very diverse community.
And I think the really important sentiment that you described is that, or the distinction we should point out is that you describe people who are, who have been pushed out when they come back in for like the First Fridays or, you know, the big art walk nights or whatever, they go to Oakland, not San Francisco, because San Francisco doesn't have that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I feel like the downtown, like the scene still has like a receptivity that they're like, it's and that I no longer feel like, I feel like San Francisco no longer feels like a super warm and welcoming place. It feels like it's made for somebody else.
Yeah, totally. So I get it now about the East Bay and your role there, essentially. I want to ask you though about being a nurse, because that's a fascinating day job to have as an artist. I've never talked to an artist who's had a day job as a nurse. So what came first, you being an artist or you being a nurse?
So I guess when I was very young, like in high school and then starting college, I was very, you know, creative. I was really into ceramics. I did some mural painting. And then I sort of decided I needed to become a nurse, that I needed to have a practical job and that I needed to, you know, it's probably somewhat related to my family structure of kind of being a caregiver. And so I very consciously was like, I need to be a grown up and I need to become a nurse. And
let me interject. Where did that inner voice come from?
So I remember this as if it's always fascinates me what you remember in life. I remember in high school, a friend of mine saying how her father didn't really want her to go to college because those kids, they get degrees in English and they end up driving a chicken delight truck. My father didn't say that. My father was totally impractical. He would not have said that, but you know, this sort of like very responsible, like insurance salesman father who was like very, you know, was said that. And I remember taking it to heart, like oh, you have to be realistic. And so there was something in me that felt like that I needed to make safety, and probably becoming a nurse was partly about making safety, which, you know, I would say none of that is false in life. I mean, it did afford me a form of I became a nurse, and then I worked in like emergency rooms. I worked in scary places, but with a safe job. Mm-hmm. So I worked in like Highland Emergency Room, and then I became a nurse practitioner, and I worked in Richmond Health Center, which was super intense county health center, and in a community that was in a huge amount of turmoil of violence and crack epidemic. Mm-hmm. And then I figured out how, a few years into that, there was suddenly like a voice in me that was like, you got to do art again. And so I started a long time. I started like in 91 or something like that, doing ceramics, and then started this, I figured out a way to do installations in the county health center and started this thing called Arts Change, where I invited all kinds of amazing different artists to come in and do projects. And I really sort of learned the world of installation, curation, and like art around social dialogue. I did that for about 14 years at the same time as being a nurse practitioner.
And these venues, did I hear you right? These venues that you were doing these shows were health facilities?
Yeah, yeah. We actually, so we, and yeah, we, particularly Richmond Health Center, which was just like the building that we started in, just like the most like asbestos filled, like mustard colored, like the ugliest building, really bad 60s design. And it was like such an ugly building. And there was a great thing because like the county health services was kind of like they knew that we couldn't do anything to make it worse. Mm-hmm. They pretty much let us do whatever we wanted.
Yeah.
Like we started out that we were supposed to do exhibitions in one like small area, and then pretty much we took over the whole, like we expanded to the whole building and painted rooms different colors. And and eventually the county got, under Obamacare, got funding to build a new West County Health Center, and the designers made their design concept around our work.
Oh,
so
wow.
They actually built the building to house the 15 years of the work of Arts Change as permanent artwork in the building.
Wow, that's fantastic. I do want to go back to your nursing work, because it's one thing that a thought that came to mind as you were describing it is you must have seen it all when it comes to physical trauma, sounds like.
Yeah. No, I worked in Children's Hospital Emergency Room, and then Highland Emergency Room, and then Richmond Health Center. So I was in the room where, you know, for codes when 16-year-olds had shot each other. And I was as a nurse practitioner, taking care of the parents of 16-year-olds who'd been murdered, or taking care of 16-year-olds who are now then paraplegics from gunshot wounds.
And wow. How have you processed those experiences over the years, or at least at that time?
I think that was part of the voice that started, that went off in me. I had twins. My children are now 30 years old, but 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So when I was pregnant with them, I started to be like, I've got to start doing some artwork. Like I can't like take care of babies and take care of tragedy in the world mm-hmm. without processing in some kind of way. And mm-hmm. I think for me, making physical works was like deeply embedded in that.
Mm-hmm. So that was cathartic and even therapeutic.
Totally. And when then I was doing work that was around social dialogue and doing installations and sculptural works around those things. But then like, I actually, as I left working at the health center and I started working much more like with really physical materials, things that I couldn't have worked at, like the health center, like doing things that were like really gross, like working with coal fat, which is like the fat that lines an animal stomach cavity.
Mm.
And we call it the omentum. And I was like, wow, I know about the omentum. And here is this like lacy reticular fat that I can like wrap around things. And I started doing things that are like stitching bacon together with suture material. So making like things that really had a like physicality, and that became a place where I like actually, as I transitioned from a world that was medicine and art to a world that was more art, mm-hmm. that was just art, mm-hmm. it became very important for me to like that was a lot of processing of going from a very practical, having a kind of work that was very practical mm-hmm. to a work that was very poetic, but still like stitching flesh.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like also going back to Joseph Beuys, who you mentioned as an influence. Yeah. And tell me about going to California College of the Arts, particularly because I would imagine that you were one of the older students there, if not the oldest. Is that fair?
No, I was like the very oldest. Okay. Happy to say. I wasn't the very oldest, okay. but I was among the oldest. There was a small group of like three or four people that were like in my cluster of age.
So that must have made you feel less alone then, I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, but the thing was, I think the thing that really made me feel less alone was that I met a few people that I'm still really close friends with, like Cassie Thornton, like Robert Gomez Hernandez, who I just finished doing this video project in Mexico with him. Mm. So I feel like I met people that some people that were like I was totally kindred spirits with, and age actually totally didn't matter.
Right.
And then I felt like I met a lot of kind of, you know, young people who couldn't really see me because I could like they just kind of felt allergic to my not being young and not being a hipster.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think that I'm glad you said the first part about the connections you made. But I think embedded in my question about your age is a concern that very young students would, particularly of these more recent generations, would not be. I don't know. Maybe that's a thing that's always been the case. Maybe it has nothing to do with right now. But they would not be as maybe open minded.
I feel like it probably is worse now.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, I thought about it a lot of experiencing the ageism at CCA and out in the art world in general, feeling a huge amount of ageism of like, how could you really be like how, you know, you're not zeitgeist, you're not of the moment, so you can't possibly like have something important to say.
Right. And there's the whole thing too, which I recognize it seems like on a monthly basis virtually, that galleries want to show people who are just emerging out of school. They don't want to show the only untested talent that they want to work with are people who are just emerging from school. They don't want to work with anybody past 35.
Yeah. And that also meant that when I got out of CCA, like I would like apply to things and I wouldn't put my age on it and I would get into them partly because I appeared to be part of the zeitgeist. So
Right.
I always feel like there's something I find it super interesting of feeling like I go back and forth. Like right where I work goes back and forth to like memories of things of my childhood to things of the current moment and feeling like, I guess I feel like I'm always kind of traveling through time.
Mm.
So, but I also am like very acutely aware of like, oh, this person's not listening to me or not looking at me because I'm not in their demographic.
Yeah. Which is ageism.
Yes.
Straight away. Yeah.
Yeah. But then and I guess the reason I was going to say that I would propose that it might be worse now mm-hmm. in that artists are so in such a precarious position
mm-hmm.
and there's so much feeling of struggle to get a foothold somewhere.
Right.
That I don't think it brings out wide-mindedness. It feels like I guess I feel like people are really struggling to make their place be important. And if that means like surrounding themselves with people that make them feel really hip,
mm-hmm.
I can dig that. I can see that.
Yeah. It's kind of a legacy. It's a maybe distorted legacy of being part of a movement, you know, or a
or a
community, you know, like the Cedar Tavern, you know, going back to the Cedar Tavern Abstract Expressionists, and, you know, and then, you know, the Eat restaurant in New York, that that sculptor whose name is eluding me right now, the guy who did Blew Through Architectural Spaces and so on. You know, it's ones that were presumably more organically, you know, put together then, whereas in more recent years, they're completely sort of strategic and contrived and whatnot.
Right. And that to me, like, gets into like super interesting territory of why I really love being a part of Dream Farm Commons, or that I in general feel like I am actually a part of an artistic conversation and actually am a part of something that is of the moment. And that this atmosphere of insecurity is promoted by people having this idea that they're about to get into this really cool gallery that's, you know, totally a part of the art market, and then they're going to start selling their work for lots of money, and then they're going to get museum gigs. And that's not going to be true for, like, that steals a lot of creativity. That striving and that disappointment. For me, it was very clear to me that, like, as a ceramicist, I had the realization very long time ago of, like, oh, I'm getting to this point where the goal should be that I should be in this, you know, this fancy gallery in San Francisco where people from Pacific Heights could buy things that I could not afford. Like, why would I want to do that? Like, why? Like it just didn't interest me. And I've never, so it hasn't concerned me to make works that are deciduous or installations that are not sellable. Like, that's never, because that's never been the more interesting part of art to me.
Right. I want to talk about Dream Farm Commons, of course, and what that is like. But before we do, I'd love to hear about, so I have this image, or I have this sense of your evolution as making ceramic art and being involved in these installations that you were doing in these health spaces that you were involved with, right? So that was kind of, I imagine those to be a kind of a combination of, get, you know, gallery installation with maybe more, a little bit of social engagement, you know, that you sort of alluded
to.
Right. Yeah. And so all that to get to, you're going to California College of the Arts. What was that experience like in terms of your learning about being involved with socially engaged art?
So I started out in the social practice program and deciding to go to at CCA.
Right.
And deciding to go to CCA was very much, I remember someone telling me, I was in this big installation in a warehouse in Richmond, and someone said to me, you should go to an MFA program when you find the person you want to work with. And then I was on like some radio program on KPFA, and there was this guy, Sanjit Sethi, and people had suggested that he and I should talk because we were both really into like using food as a method of social engagement and as an art material. So we were on this radio show together, and then we started like putting projects together in Richmond, and he was a part of the social practice program at CCA. And I was like, I think the moment's here. I think this is when I'm supposed to get an MFA. So he was my advisor. So I ended up doing the MFA over 3 years, because the first year I was still working at Richmond Health Center, and my head was kind of spinning around like the girl in the
The Exorcist?
In The Exorcist, yeah, the girl in The Exorcist. That, you know, it's just like such, it was like you couldn't have two worlds more different than a county health center in Richmond and CCA in the Dogpatch area of San Francisco, and these like really awesome, gorgeous buildings. And I felt like confused. And so I decided like I needed to slow it down, and that I could spend a year like taking more philosophy classes, working in the wood shop, like learning different things, and like really drink in like a different art moment. And really grapple with this question of what was the difference between socially engaged art or community-based art practice and I know I'm using the word practice, sorry, but social practice. And social practice,
okay,
it's a thing.
Yep.
So that, and it felt very, really felt quite confusing to me for the first like year of like, you know, how do, where are the boundaries? And then I really, then, you know, I came to understand that social practice is a very wide umbrella that isn't real clear of its boundaries. But that there were some really great differences that I quite appreciated.
Right. Just out of curiosity, were people aware, you know, you started at CCA and you were still working at the hospital, as you said, were some of the students aware of that, and were they intrigued or curious?
Well, that was very interesting. Like there was a few people who were like super interested in it. Most people, that was kind of fascinating to me, that I realized that everyone in the medical world was super interested in the art world, and that most, particularly the younger students who were kind of allergic to my age, were also very much not interested in something out of their world.
Right.
So they actually didn't really want to know about it.
Wow.
Or just like it didn't exist.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a kind of, you know, hyper focus of like their world needing to be the world.
Yeah. Wow. Hmm. So as I told you in our earlier conversation, one of the way that I sort of introduced the show now is podcast about the contemporary art worlds, plural, right? So what you're doing at Dream Farm Commons is for an audience that maybe is very different from the audience that goes to many of the commercial galleries in San Francisco, perhaps, right?
Yeah, the super commercial galleries. I mean, I feel like we have, I think you're, the audience is the world. There's this Zapatista saying that actually comes very directly from Mayan thought, that another, so in Spanish, it's otro mundo es posible, un mundo que quepan muchos mundos, which is another world is possible, a world that fits many worlds.
Right. Which you have in your statement for your show.
Yeah. And I think that, like, I just totally love that way. It's like a way of thinking about social change in general, that we're not in an era of, you know, single manifestos, or that the international will be the solution, that like we have to find many solutions, and that we have to have many audiences. And so I guess I feel like kind of our placement, like we'll do an opening where we put out, we've been doing this thing of putting out a table with a big humongous pot of rice and beans, and we'll feed people who are really hungry on the street. And then we'll feed, you know, artists who might be kind of hungry too. And then we'll feed people that are art viewers that are not so hungry. So I guess I feel like, I guess the sense of community is probably around people who are interested in work that's not, you know, it's not just like big paintings that go in lobbies of the new condos.
Yeah. When you feed the people out on the street who are really hungry, is there not necessarily an expectation, but maybe a hope that they'll come in and be part of the show, the opening?
Actually, it totally happens. Like we have relationships with people who wouldn't probably go to just any gallery, but because we're being a part of the neighborhood, they'll come in.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's clearly, I mean, a very specific and contrasting type of gallery system or MO than a lot of commercial galleries, where it's almost the opposite. You know, there's this offhandedness, you know, or off-puttingness, uninviting, kind of intimidating, etc.
So you're
going in the opposite direction.
And people are like, so like I'm kind of chatty. So people will come in and I'll just like talk to them, and I'll be like, you know, it could be like a you know, student from CCA. And I'll be like, oh, I went to CCA, and, you know, ask them about their classes. And they're so surprised because they're, you know, there's well put together installations, but we're not creating that vibe of like silently sitting behind the desk and glancing up and,
sure,
you know, not, it's not that vibe.
Right. So. Yeah. And speaking of what you're doing right now, as we're talking, is you're in the space, right? And you, and your open hours, yeah, are, is it Thursday through Saturday, like 12 to 6 or something like that?
Yes. Yes.
So, you haven't had any visitors, right, since we've been on the phone, which is probably good, definitely good for us. But what are your, do you have expectations, bottom lines, or is it more like, you know, let it be, not worry about the attendance?
I really like, yeah, so I have the door closed, mm-hmm, just because it would, it's a little quieter. And I guess I also didn't want to, like, when I want to be most inviting, the door is open.
Right.
So we have a sandwich board outside. And when I want to be most inviting, the door is open.
Right.
And it's not open right now.
Right.
My expectation or sort of bottom line is, like, I really hope every day there's, like, a really interesting conversation.
Mm.
And almost every day there is. I mean, every once in a while, but I can kind of dig when it's super quiet and it just gives me time to work on something else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I can dig that too. Yeah, it would, there's a little bit of a problem that, like, working with our door open, one of the computer snatchers came in and snatched a computer a few,
ooh,
weeks ago. So,
wow.
So it kind of, like, it's kind of, it's altered a little bit of our openness.
Right,
like,
right,
now we have a, well, we have a chain to put around the computer when we're working at it on the desk.
Right. Was somebody at, were you or somebody else actually in the room when the computer was grabbed away?
So, yeah, so we were both, this was fascinating. So it was, Danielle Wright had this really great piece called The White Privilege Research Room.
Mm.
And we had, she's a Black artist. We had but there was a giant sign in the window that said White Privilege Research Room, which of course was, you know, like, people, everybody took like double takes, like, is this a white supremacist site or what's up?
Right.
So, but it looked otherwise, looked sort of like a therapist, like a Black therapist's office, that there was, you know, artwork that was like from Black artists. And then there was a couch and our desk there. And I was sitting on the couch typing away on my computer, and Jess Young, that, Dream Farm Commons intern, was sitting at the desk with her fingers on the computer. And this slick young guy, like, I like barely glanced up and, like, noticed that he had an attractive, shiny, green silk jacket. And, but, like I was just registering the jacket, and he was out the door. He grabbed the computer from under her fingers.
Jesus. That's wild.
I know.
That is wild. Huh.
It was super invasive. It was,
yeah,
really,
that's got to change the tenor of the space for at least a little bit.
Yeah, well, it made me be more, like, cautious. You know, there's a certain level. Like, when I was a nurse, when I first started working as a nurse in Richmond, one of the older nurses told me, oh, when you're making a home visit, there's an angel over your shoulder. Like, wear your stethoscope on your shoulders, and people will know you're a nurse. And then the angel is watching as well. And it actually kind of, like, worked for me, like, that I would make home visits in, like, really, like, rough kind of places, but I would be like, I'm covered.
Right.
And there's some kind of presumption that I probably operate under of, like, I'm here, you know, I'm here in a good social dialogue. I'm covered.
Right.
And it's not totally, like, it made me kind of be like, okay, what kind of white privilege is that?
Yeah.
Like, why do I think that I'm exempt from, you know, and there's a certain amount of, like, here we are, the White Privilege Research Room. A young kid is coming in, and somehow, you know, he's reclaiming some wealth. And it's, like, not at all that I want to give any carte blanche for computer snatching, but there's also a certain kind of operating, like, let's be real, let's operate within, like, I need a chain on the computer when it's at the desk, because otherwise somebody will snatch it.
Was this event a symbol of, in some way, of the edge that Oakland still has, perhaps?
It's Yeah, totally. I mean, it's totally a thing, the computer snatching.
Okay.
I didn't know that. And to tell you the truth, we had the same thing happen a year ago, but it had a very different ending. That the intern was sitting outside selling T-shirts at this round table. A kid came on a scooter, asked her something about the T-shirts, snatched the computer, and I ran after them like a demon, screaming and saying, "Stop him, stop him." And three kids on bicycles went after him, and he dropped the computer, and we got it back.
Mm.
So that was ultimately a tale of urban equity,
right.
Or like it worked out. Like I felt so like protected by the neighborhood. And
why do you think
that.
You didn't run after the guy with the green silk jacket?
I did. Nobody did anything, and he got away. I did exactly the same thing. I ran,
and there were
kind of, you know, kids on bikes that were just like into it. Like, yeah, and the people that were walking along were mostly looked. You know, I sort of coded like, oh, they're all tech workers and they don't care or whatever. But anybody,
right. Whatever
it was, nobody put their foot out to trip the fast running kid.
right. So going back to the space, to the project, Dream Farm Commons, what is it like keeping the doors open? What is the general sort of financial equation to keep it running, keep it sustainable?
Well, we're trying to figure that out. Like, we're really totally trying to figure that out. We're doing kind of multi-stream kind of things of writing some grants. We do some events where we bring in a little money. We have a writer who's using the space as a workspace.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're putting money in, and we're trying to get it. Like, I feel like we're at a kind of, I don't really know what. Like, it's working right now, and we're trying to develop more streams so it works better.
Mm-hmm.
The part of the equation that I know is working really well is that we're having really good exhibitions. We're having exactly the kinds of discourse that I hoped we might have.
Mm-hmm.
One of the encuentros, one of these things that we were planning to either decolonize the imagination or practical border action, one of them is Ignacio Valero, who's a like really brilliant thinker, talking about the colonization of our emotions, the emotariat. And then Beatriz Escobar, who's a Brazilian artist who has been thinking about how colonialism changes horizons and how we might hold multiple horizons.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pairing in a sort of, so there's things that are like exactly at the level of kind of visuality and discourse that I hoped we might achieve, and a variety of different voices that are coming up really strongly in that way and that are kind of, you know, forming some core in Dream Farm Commons. So those things are like that, like that's like really very real and very and building, and like we're getting, you know, I feel like we're getting better at those things,
right?
And getting more audience for those things and
right.
more gravitas in that.
Hmm.
How like does the economy of it seem precarious? Yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is the works in the show for sale? Any given show?
Yeah.
And what is
your? We've sold a few pieces.
Uh-huh.
But not a ton. And like I would say, very interesting. This particular show, we didn't put a price list out, not for any particular reason.
Right.
I mean, I think it's working more as an installation.
Mm-hmm.
But we would certainly, upon request, would certainly generate the prices. You know, we've only been in operation a year and
mm-hmm.
4 months, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would like, I think I made a much bigger, like, you know, again, so one of those things about like the gallery tropes where you have to have the binder with the bios and the price list.
Right.
And I felt like who looks at, like, if somebody's interested in buying something, they say something to me like, oh, I really like that piece. I'm really thinking I would like to buy it.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I know
yeah.
they want to buy it. Or,
right.
you know, then we can have that conversation and blah, blah, blah.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I was just thinking about is, you know, as I was starting to ask you about the relative sustainability and the challenge of keeping the doors open of your commons, is there a hard line between a commercial space and a collective space, you know, as far as being successful with sales, you know? Like, do you almost have to go all in to actually have reliable sales? Or, you know, or more likely there's a spectrum, you know what I mean? Because as you said.
I think there's a spectrum, but I think there's levels of intention. You know, I think you start a space and you have a structure of decision-making and you have intentions that you build structures around those intentions.
Yeah.
So if your intention is to really be a part, you know, to really work with art marketers and, art consultants and to get the lobby of new condos business, that's a particular intention.
Mm-hmm.
And if your intention is really around creating, like, really stimulating levels of discourse and crossing different kinds of social boundaries and pushing on social boundaries, it's a different set of intentions.
Sure. I do want to say this has been such a stimulating conversation. I'm really happy to have it with you. Is there anything that you would be remiss if we didn't get to, or do you feel, it feels like we've covered a fair amount, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. I do. I feel like we talked about things that I was super interested in. And, oh, you wanted me to say the whites of the eyes of the audience.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We almost forgot that. Yeah. So tell me about that.
Well, I guess I could sort of speak about that relative to kind of Dream Farm Commons and the immediacy of being in a storefront.
Sure.
And that I, in general, for my own art making, physical making, I can be so happy working in the studio, and like I love the kind of things of the space of creative production, of like when the story gets going and all the pieces are kind of like, you know, you're like in totally in when I'm totally in conversation with the creative process. But that generally happens when I have some proximity, when I can like see the whites of the eyes of the audience, when I have some proximity to the audience. And doing that from a totally sort of distance kind of, you know, I think like we have like certain mythologies about studio artists, and that I think for a lot of visual artists, it's about being in conversation with the audience in the same way that a musician, like they want to be in conversation, like playing music by yourself and playing music for an audience is a different thing.
Yeah.
So to me, like when we were talking earlier about the kinds of creative energy that's lost in like striving for the, you know, to become an art star. Like, I think it's super valid for artists to figure out places to make their own things happen. Mm-hmm. And we're doing like really serious exhibitions that's not just about like a pay to play of showing our own work, but doing like showing other people's works and like bringing things, you know, creating a level of artistic production, of consistent artistic production. And that like waiting for somebody to give you that opportunity to be in a window, I just feel like artists, like in general, we need to like claim it.
Mm-hmm.
Like we need to figure out different ways of doing things. Like I guess I feel like the narrative that people get when they finish CCA right now, their exhibition show is at Minnesota Projects, which is like this beautiful San Francisco space that's like super elegant. And there's some like high-end galleries that are in the space, and they have like 6 hours to hang their show and like throw things up, but they get this like moment of like totally being like in the elegant presentation of their work.
Right.
And then they're thrown out in the world clamoring for, when do they get the big opportunity to be the place where somebody's going to buy their work for $16,000?
Mm.
And like, you know, that's going to happen every once in a while, but it's often like not going to happen. And like the crime that MFA programs, isn't this the statistic that 95% of the people who finish MFA programs are not actively living as artists 5 years later?
Is that financial? Is that financially?
That was the statistic that was relevant. And who knows what that means? Maybe means self-supporting as artists. I don't know what that means. But I do know that a whole lot of people feel like they didn't, like there's that golden, what we were talking about, that little period of ageism, you know, the fresh eggs on the shelf of the young artist that comes out, and either like you're going to make it and you're going to, you know, be at, you know, at SF MoMA or, you know, at wherever you're going to be at the Tate in 5 years, or you're not happening. And that's just like so, like such a ripoff.
Yeah.
Such a ripoff of creative potential.
Where do you think those expectations or, you know, dreams or what have you, where do they come from most, would you say?
Well, I guess, I mean, we live in a spectacle society, and we go to, you know, I love going to museums. I know a lot of social practice artists who say, like, museums are terrible places. I don't think that at all. Like, I love going and seeing giant retrospectives of really awesome artists, of particularly feminist artists who do kind of bodily kinds of things, like Mona Hatoum or whatever. I love seeing gigantic shows like that. And that's like taking, you know, it's like taking things to an extreme of how you might be able to present work in the biggest kind of way. But I think we're there, and but there's this, there's supposed to be like this feeding chain that's supposed to take you towards that, that like you're supposed to be in small galleries that are then going to feed into larger galleries that are then going to take you into the museum.
Right.
And that is sometimes a trajectory, but I don't really know the answer to your question. I'm fascinated with the question.
Mm.
You know, artists are really smart and analytic people. And like, how do we let ourselves lose our creative momentum to a very limited narrative?
Right.
And I'm sure it had something to do with capitalism and the spectacle and all of that. But I can't exactly
connect the dots. Sure, sure. I appreciate the attempt and the beginnings of an answer. Anne, this has been so great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it a lot.
Thanks so much again to Anne. I hope, as I touted at the beginning of the show, that you did find that stimulating and interesting. If you have any thoughts about it, of course, feel free to reach out to us via the website. Again, have some great old news/Weiss links to get to today, including a very provocative one at the end. Before we do, wanted to remind you that this is a listener-supported show, and people who support the show financially come and go all the time. So if you are on the fence or have been for a while about supporting the show financially, now would be a great time to come on board. We are, I believe, up to 11 bonus episodes now, and with a one-time financial donation to the show of $35 or more, you'll get all of the bonus episodes, a bumper sticker of the podcast if you want one. And of course, you will get on the mailing list so you'll be alerted for all upcoming bonus episodes. You can support the show, of course, a few different ways: via PayPal, via Patreon as an ongoing donor. You can do that for as little as $1 a month. Although if you're in the $10 a month club, you're golden. You can also support one time via Venmo. You can even support the show with a good old-fashioned check if you want. All of those options, you can reach us through theconversationpod.com/support to find out more and to link to PayPal and so on. You can also support the show by leaving a great review on Apple Podcasts, 5 stars, por favor, or whatever platform you listen on. You can follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast. And of course, spreading the word about this show really does help and make a difference. We really want to get our name out there still, all these almost 8 years later. So your spreading the word is very much appreciated. And I do want to thank our producers, invaluable Andy Davis, who helps guide us through tightening the episodes to their best. New producer Amanda Roth, who is helping with the guest cue. And Now let's move on to the old news as compiled by myself and producer Megan Bickle. So, are art fairs in trouble? The Financial Times diagnoses a number of challenges facing art fairs today, including the rising fair fatigue, the hefty cost of relentless international travel, and growing concerns about the environmental impact of such large-scale events. Galleries are also taking more control of their schedules today, either by shifting to offer more works online or by doubling down at home with increasingly museum-like spaces. In the end, said Gagosian Sam Orlovsky, art fairs are the biggest threat to art fairs. That's from the Financial Times and ArtNet. Now, you may have been hearing some stuff about Desert X following an LA Times piece titled Desert X Art Exhibition Heads to Saudi Arabia. Comes this from ArtNet once again. Desert X organizers have ignited a firestorm. Quote, I resigned because I felt like Desert X no longer reflected my humanitarian values, Lipschultz tells ArtNet News. I don't want to aid in rebranding Saudi Arabia as a somehow enlightened, credible government. The partnership between the biennial and the kingdom was announced almost exactly a year to the day after the murder of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The CIA has accused Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, of ordering the killing, and a UN report released in July also holds Saudi Arabia responsible. Before moving forward with the plan, Davis says she and Wakefield reached out to organizations that had severed ties with Saudi partners to ask about their experiences. She says these groups are probably, quote, just biding their time until they engage again, unquote. They also reached out to artists who they plan to include in the new edition to ask their advice on whether to move ahead. Quote, from my knowledge, virtually every artist said it's more important to engage than isolate, she says. Artists who have visited the kingdom ahead of the project include Lita Albuquerque, Sharon Gerges, and the Danish collective Superflex. I think art transcends a lot of political issues, Albuquerque told the Los Angeles Times. Gerges said she was interested in, quote, exploring what it means to make art under these kinds of conditions, unquote. But Cade L. Twist, who along with Cristobal Martinez makes up the collective Post-Commodity, which exhibited in the 2019 edition, says no one from Desert X contacted him or Martinez about the Saudi partnership. Twist says the expansion of the biennial speaks to the art world's lack of accountability. It's an unregulated market. It's an unregulated industry. Curators are self-declared, artists are self-declared, and there's very little oversight as to where money comes from and how it's spent. We would never exhibit with any form of Desert X again, he adds. The Saudi state is funding Desert X Al Ula, as the show will be known, but local activists and community organizers raised separate concerns. Environmental scholar and writer Ruth Nolan wrote on Facebook that the art installations had done, quote, irreparable damage to, quote, desert flora and fauna, and wrote in an op-ed for the Desert Sun that the show evinced a, quote, land-grab mentality that evokes the worst of the California gold rush. Meanwhile, some artists complained of a lack of organization and direction. Twist, the member of Post Commodity, said his collective fronted the $22,000 necessary to fund their installation in Palm Springs and were only reimbursed in July after they involved a lawyer. A Desert X spokesperson says that according to the organization's records, Post Commodity was paid in full before July. Quote, they don't even have the capacity as an organization to do what they're already doing, Twist says. They've demonstrated a lack of capacity to support the artists and a lack of professionalism. Now to some shorter pieces. How to foray into the art market and freeze. The best quote I got was from an unnamed critic who said, quote, of course paintings are still popular. They're portable money laundering devices. That's tweeted by Lanra Bakar. Speaking of Twitter, paintings dominate Freeze London as buyers shun, quote, risky installations. That's from The Guardian UK. And finally for this week, in a tweet titled Foundation Byler. Hello, my name is Sam Keller. You may remember me when I ran Art Basel. My new purpose in life is to preside over the destruction of one of the great European museums. Where previously we hung Giacometti and Monet, we now have Jordan Wolfson, Rudolf Stengel, and Jonas Wood. I used to run an art fair, and now I'm turning the Foundation Byler into something that looks like one. My favorite thing is to do shows of artists that are represented by mega galleries. Who needs connoisseurship when you can just play the market? That is from What an Artshole on Twitter. All right, guys, that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Do let us know what you think. Please spread the word. I'll talk to you soon. Until then, ciao for now.